Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's June 14, 2011, and this is episode 290. Another treat for us this week, as I'm really excited to be joined by David Duchemin today. And David is, I'm sure you all know, but he's a world and humanitarian photographer, best-selling author, and all-round amazing guy. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you, Martin. It's good to be here. How are you?
I'd like to say I'm really, really good.
It's a loaded question.
Yeah. So obviously, I mean, as a lot of people heard last week when I was, I sort of dropped a bomb on my guest last week, Iberian Exparillo, that I've got a little bit of a problem in that I found out that I got a brain tumor last week. And we're currently doing tests trying to get that, you know, see what it looks like and then find out, draw up a blueprint of how we're going to treat that. But in the sort of aftermath of talking about that, you know, David and I got chatting, and, you know, I also am fully aware because my heart went out to you, 40 odd days ago, David, when you had a fall on your workshop in Italy, was that?
I think it's about seven this weekend. It was 7 weeks since I fell. I was on a workshop in Pisa, Italy, and made a bad decision on something that seemed like a very benign shooting situation, and I was on a wall in Italy and hopped over an edge. And when I got to this sort of, there was a secondary ledge, and when I landed on that, I have some weak ankles from rock climbing, and I think what happened is I just landed the wrong way, and my ankle rolled, I lost my balance, and I kept going because I fell about 30 feet, and I landed on concrete, shattered both my ankles, and broke my pelvis, and did some soft tissue damage to one of my wrists. Oof. And I got to tell you, it was it was horrific.
I can imagine.
It was nothing I had expected for that evening. I had all kinds of plans, and none of them involved falling off that wall. And that, you know, as you well know from your own circumstance, you suddenly you're faced with a brand new reality.
And, oh yes.
And I was there. I knew very well. You know, I'm pretty. I know my body, and I kind of, you know, I knew that my ankles were broken. I knew that something was wrong with my pelvis. My wrist, I thought it was broken at the time, and so, you know, they pulled me up. There was a big cherry picker that, you know, they lowered this sledge with the paramedics on it, and they got me into the ambulance. And from the time they sort of picked me up and put me on the ambulance through to a medical evacuation that took place about 4 days later, then surgeries in Ottawa, where I'm originally from, but haven't called home for years, but my family is here. It was about 40 days of hospitalization, and now I'm sort of recovering at my family's home south of Ottawa. So it's been a bit of an unexpected detour in my own adventure.
I saw your recent blog post in which you'd got the photos of you crawling around the house, and that was pretty heart wrenching to tear wrenching. You know, obviously I've known of you and you know for quite a while now. I've read most of your ebooks, and I've read Within the Frame, and I still have a bookmark at the beginning of Vision Mongers. But I, and I should be reading that because I started my own photography business last year. But you know, it really is heart wrenching or tear wrenching when you see someone like yourself who gives so much, in such a predicament. You know, and this is, I mean, I want to quickly give a huge thank you out to all of my followers and listeners that have given support over this last week since I dropped my bomb on Iberian X and I think that night I went public again. I put a blog post out there that in which I basically, you know, I'm not one for hiding things away. So I basically just sort of poured my heart out into a blog post for an hour, and I just want to say thanks to everybody online, you yourself, David, as well. But there's been so many people that have wished me well, keeping me in their prayers, and it is a tough time, and I know that you've probably been through this exact same thing over this last 40 days, David. But it's tough when you're faced with this sort of thing, And it's really, really helped me to keep strong, to have to know that there are so many people around the world that are pulling for me.
Yeah, you know what? You're absolutely right. It is tough, and there are some days that are harder than others. And it's funny, I've had a number of people that saw those same photographs and said, "Oh my gosh, it must be so hard." And that was one of the better days for me because I finally come home and I was out of the wheelchair and, you know, at least temporarily, and, you know, climbing upstairs, and I had new challenges. But you're absolutely right. The support of the photography community has. There have been days when, you know, I was lying in a hospital and all I had was my Twitter feed and my blog. And people telling me, "Hey, you know what, we're rooting for you, we're thinking about you, we're praying for you." And the support and kindness of people from around the world has overwhelmed me at times. I mean, I've just laid in my hospital bed with tears streaming down my face, in part because I was so frustrated and I was just so, you know, there was loneliness and frustration and doubt and fear and where's this going to take me? But more than that, just to these people are just so generous. I mean, my blog readers, and I know yours are among, you know, we share a readership, and they're my new heroes. They are so kind. They are so giving and supportive. And none of us know what's, you know, how we're going to get through these things. And, you know, life is fragile. But to experience that and have this kind of support, it's a gift.
It is. It really has knocked me back, you know, in a good way. Maybe that's not a good way to say that, but I really have been just totally blown away by the response of the photography community. You joked in an email earlier saying, you know, something about we need to carpe the crap out of the DM. And so I think, you know, we're going to be forming this society. It's a not so secret society anymore, called the Paul Lee Photographers Society. And me and David are inaugural members.
So, yeah, it's alternately titled the Not Quite Dead Photographers Society. I think I'll go for a walk now.
Yeah.
No, you won't.
Not quite dead. Yeah, that's better.
I'll fall out my living room. How's that?
Yeah. The thing is, though, is that we want this to be really elite. We don't want to hear of the next photographer getting poorly. You know, obviously, if somebody does, you're welcome to join the society. And we can go and perform some sort of secret rites in a cave somewhere. But stay healthy, everybody. And I actually, you know, that's probably unintentionally a good segue into the next sort of topic, in that, you know, I mean, we really do. When something like this happens to you, and I'm sure that you'll concur, David, it really, really gives you a totally different outlook on life. You know, we don't want anyone else to be getting similar news to what I've had this last week, or falling off walls and stuff. But you know, once it's happened to you, it changes your outlook on life, and I think it probably changes your outlook on life forever.
It can't help but to do so. I think, you know, especially when you come face to face with how fragile things are.
Yeah.
One moment everything's great and you're laughing with friends, and the next moment you're thinking, I nearly died. And, you know, the wall that I fell off has a bit of a history, I guess primarily with tourists who don't know it, but the two people that fell off the same wall I did this year, neither of them lived. And so I feel very grateful to have, you know, to have fallen in just the right way. One of the Italian newspapers, where they got their information, I'm not sure, but they suggested that I was literally falling head first. And before I hit the ground, I decided that was not a good activity. Mm. And I righted myself like a cat and landed on my feet. And someone translated it for me. I thought, my gosh, I wish that had been true. You know, it sounds like a really good story. I fell and happened to be, you know, falling feet first.
But maybe, you know, maybe like you have nine lives, David.
Well, who knows, right? Yeah. I think I've just checked through a couple of them, but you know, you're right. Life is very fragile, and it can't help but affect your, you know, your viewpoint on things. And hopefully, it changes things for the better. Hopefully, it does make you, you know, seize the day, and it does make you more conscious of moments. I mean, that's, as photographers, what we're about is moments, and to be more conscious of not only that they're out there and they're fleeting, but that they are all we have. They are beautiful, and even if you have no camera in hand, we should be looking at life as a series of moments, because the fact is none of us are guaranteed to live through the day, the week, the year, and the more we value and love those moments, I think the more able we are to enjoy life while we have it.
Yeah, absolutely. What you just said kind of reminds me of within the frame. Again, I mean, I can't stress how much I love your book Within the Frame.
Thank you.
It's just, I think that let me see. I'm just going to go off on a tangent here. I think it's okay. It's my
All right. All
podcast.
right. You let me know when you're done. I'll just start drinking heavily over on this side.
No, you jump in at any time, David. But
All right.
you know what? I often say to people that, I mean, I even said in my recording last week with Iberian X, that I don't think I'm a very creative person. But Within the Frame, to me, made that okay. And the reason for that is because you talk about it somewhere in the middle of the book about where the important thing is getting to a place at the right time, or roughly the right time, depending on your scouting and everything, with the right amount of equipment, and be receptive to the creativity, or to be sort of in a frame of mind that allows the place to present itself with the photos. And this is very much how I work. I know people that I would consider to be so much more creative than me, or at least that's how I often say it. But what it actually is that there are people that I feel have much better visualization skills, I think should be the way I put it. When I read Within the Frame, I thought, well, okay, maybe I don't need to be so tough on myself, because that's how I work. I do enough preparation to know when I should be where, and then I get there. And although I don't always have, I'll often have ideas of the sort of images that I can get, but I often don't feel as though I'm brimming with creativity until I actually get there and I plug myself into the environment, and then it starts to flow. And that is one of the things that I took away from Within the Frame that really sort of changed my outlook on photography, or at least my outlook of me, how I think about me. Because I always used to beat myself up about not being as creative as some people. But I don't think it's that really is about creativity. It's more about visualization, and Within the Frame allowed me to lighten up on myself with regards to that.
I think it's good to hear. I think th that's a reasonable expectation for everyone. I mean, the reality is, unless you, if you're going to new places, you don't know, even if you're going to places that are familiar to you, you have no idea what moments are about to transpire, what the light is going to do. All these juxtapositions that happen in life with people and light and moments, and you have no idea. And sometimes those expectations, you go thinking you're a very clever, creative person, you're going to do this and you're going to do that. It leaves you blind and unreceptive to the things that actually occur. And so then you come home and you beat yourself up a little bit more. And all of us creatives are really, most of us, unless we're divas, are really good at beating ourselves up and saying, oh, my stuff is rubbish and I'm no good at this and I'm just going to sell my stuff, or, and ultimately, creatives are always like that. But you are who you are. You work the way you work. So don't beat yourself up. Just figure out, like, how do I best work? Like, my creativity will, I believe we are all creative. Yes, there are some people that are more uniquely creative. There are some people that are much more, they're pioneers in creativity, but we are all creative people. It's really a question of how are you creative and then nurturing that. And some of us will, when I go to a new place, I beat myself up for 2 or 3 days because I'm like, I'm not seeing what I thought I'd see. And it takes me a while to kind of unpack those expectations and go, why did you even have those expectations? You didn't know what you were going to see. So just relax, let I keep telling my students, you can't photograph a place unless you've experienced it. So just experience it for a while. Put the cameras in your bag and just go walk and drink some tea and have something to eat and meet some people and let the experiences begin to kind of gain some momentum. And then you find there's all of us are creative, whether you can pre-visualize or not. Martin, I'm rubbish at pre-visualizing. I mean, once in a while it happens, but I wouldn't say that those are my best photographs. My best photographs are the ones where I'm looking somewhere else and I turn around and go, ooh, ooh, oh, 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 and I, you know, I fire off three frames and I happen to get it, and it's some fluke. And that takes, you know, there's 100 frames behind or in front of that that didn't work out because I missed the moment entirely. Mm. There is an element, I think, of serendipity, just being receptive. Beating yourself up about whether we are or not creative is just wasted energy.
Mm. And that is what I learned, one of the major things that I learned from Within the Frame. You allowed me to be a little bit more easy on myself. Also, you know, I mean, I think that you also gave the photography world, or, you know, I don't want to say industry so much, but you gave photographers, in my opinion, a language or a vocabulary to talk about this stuff, because talking about creativity and the creative process, it's hard. And I think that until Within the Frame, we often found ourselves sort of trying to make sense of it, trying to talk about it in a certain way that didn't always work out. But I really think that you gave the photography community a gift in this book, in that you gave us the words. You spelled it out in a way that made it understandable. So, you know, it really is... This might be a good time to say that I'll throw some of Amazon affiliate links into the blog post for this episode, which will be at mbp.ac/290 290. And if you don't already have a copy of Within the Frame, then you know, you need to be flailed with a cat of nine tails. But then you might end up in the Poorly Photographers Society. So joking aside, you know, you should have a copy. But if you don't, use one of those links and you'll support the show, and you'll also support David. I will put links into the show notes for some of David's books. So take a look there, and there'll be one for Within the Frame as well.
That's great. Right, can I jump on something you said? I'm certainly appreciative of what you said, and I honestly never thought of it that way. And I think I probably wouldn't have looked at it myself. But I think photographers, one of the things that is interesting to me is that we're so, we tend to kind of gather in these little photography ghettos and in the larger arts and larger arts and creativity communities. Mm. They're already talking about creativity and process, and you know, if you read anything that any writers have written about writing, writers, of course, you know, being writers, they're bound to write about the thing. Photographers are not going to photograph about their creative process and come up with anything that's helpful. Mm. But writers are really good at it. And I think we impoverish ourselves by not looking at how other people approach creativity. And photographers don't generally, you know, we think we got to go out there, pre-visualize some magic thing and make these beautiful photos and lots of beautiful photographs in one session. You get writers, they do exactly the opposite. They sit down, they do the hard work, they pound it out. They don't even exactly know what they're going to be writing about that day. They just start and they write for a few hours and they do the work and they get it done. And in that, they have their own processes, they have their own rituals, they have all of these particular things that just make their creativity, but they don't navel gaze so much. They just sit and do the work. And photographers think that they're going to go out with, you know, a head full of inspiration and they're going to create these beautiful things. It's just like anyone else. It's hard work. You got to put the paint on the canvas. You got to push it around. Yeah. You got to get your hands in the clay. And eventually, yeah, if you're receptive and you let some of this stuff go, these moments of grace kind of happen and you create some beautiful stuff. But it's, you know, it's nice kind of you to say that I've given sort of a language to this. But I hope really what I've done is just simply given people permission to just go out and try this stuff and to let it go a little bit. Because I think photographers need to kind of, we're talking about receptivity. That's much more difficult than just to go out and bang off a bunch of photographs that we already have in our mind because we visited a bunch of stock libraries or Googled images about Venice. Mm. If you go and you encounter a place and, you know, being receptive is much harder because you might not see anything for the first 3 days. You might wander around going, man, why did I come here? This is expensive and horrific. Mm. It may only be the third day when you finally come to grips with your disappointment and all of that stuff that you go, now I get what I'm supposed to be photographing. Now I
Mm.
get how I see this place. I see it as a disappointment. And then you start photographing that, and then, oh my gosh, there's a surprise. There's something good in the disappointment. And suddenly you come out with this body of work you never expected to. But to go into it with expectation, I think, frankly, it's arrogant. And I'm not sure there's a lot of, especially for creative people that rely so heavily on serendipity and luck as raw materials. We should be going in with much greater receptivity and much less expectation on all of these things. And that's probably a good lesson in life because, as you and I well know, you wake up one morning and think the day is going to go one way. And by the time you're going to bed, your head's filled with a brand new reality and you're wondering how on earth you're going to make it through.
Oh yes. Yeah. Something that occurred to me just then as well. I know that not everybody has the means to get to some of the places that we visit. I mean, you visit many more places than I go as well, at least so far. But I mean, I'm lucky in that I live in Japan and we've got some of the best wildlife and the best beautiful natural spots in the world here. And I'm going to say you're lucky. I mean, obviously you've made yourself what you are, but compared to some people, you're kind of lucky that you get to go to some of the places that you go to as well. What have Do you have any advice for someone that is stuck in what might be considered by some, or even the person that we're talking about here, as a boring old town, a dull place, and they don't have the means to get to India or Japan or whatever? Do you have any advice for those sort of people?
Yeah, and if I could put it really bluntly, stop moping around. The reality is, and I get people all the time that go, "Oh, what are you bitching about? You're in Venice, you're in Kathmandu." You've got to be careful not to be seduced by the place you're in, because people that live in Kathmandu, they don't see it as some epic place where
Sure.
there's amazing photographic opportunities around the, every corner. Same thing for people in Venice. For me to go to Venice is travel photography. For someone who lives in Venice, it's just plain old Venice. But the fact is, we don't photograph novelty. We photograph juxtapositions, we photograph moments, we photograph light, we photograph lines, and all of that can be done no matter where you live. It is just as hard to photograph in Venice as it is in the same plain, boring places you live. Now, I'm blessed. I love the kind of work I do. I love to travel. Clearly, you have a passion for Japan. But Japan is now your home, and it's no easier for you to go out and photograph amazing things than it is for someone who lives in Toronto or New York. I mean, there are photographers who have made entire careers photographing in their backyards in places like New York City. So it can happen. It is just difficult. Photography is always difficult. The light has to be there. The moment has to be there. And that's what makes us look at an amazing photograph and go, "Oh, look at that." Because we know it's not around every corner. We know that it's not, an everyday thing. To get it really, well, I mean, I spent this evening looking at more work from Elliot Erwitt. He's got an iPad app out that's incredible. And I love his work. And I look at some of his stuff and think, he must have waited months or years to get that shot. I mean, he may have not waited at that spot, but he must have had these juxtapositions and thoughts in his mind, and it would have taken him a long time to just get that moment. And so for any of us, whether you're in Venice or stuck in Seattle or wherever it is you are, the raw materials are the same thing, and probably the stuff that you go to a new place and you photograph, and you're just like, "Oh, everywhere you turn, you can't take a bad photograph." I've heard so many people say, "You just can't take a bad photograph there." And I go, "Really? Because I've seen a lot of really bad ones. And some of them are in your portfolio." You can, in fact, take really bad photographs wherever you go. You can also take really beautiful, transcendent, true photographs wherever you are. And that's one of the things I love about the iPad, or sorry, the iPhone camera movement is people are finally carrying cameras everywhere, and they're taking these easy to take photographs from anywhere, from their backyard. And there's some beautiful stuff coming. It may only be, whatever, 4 or 5 megapixels, and it may not be, all kinds of, different focal lengths, but there's some beautiful work coming out of it. And I think it's because people are walking around the places they live, they're familiar with, and they don't have a bag full of gear. They just have one simple camera that allows them to do their thing.
I agree. I mean, that there are limitations to a camera like that, and you're never going to get a close up of a Red Crown crane's head with one. unless they bring out an iPhone with an 840 millimeter lens on it. But with the focal length and the limitations understood, you know, even 4 megapixels. One of my best selling prints was shot with a D30. It was a 3 megapixel camera. Hmm. And sure, I mean, people sometimes order that print at A3 plus, which 13 by 19, and it'll handle that if I put the border on it. But if they ask for it to the edges of the paper, it does get a little bit soft. I have to do some sharpening, sure. And I've disabled the ability for people to even order anything larger than that. But you know, still, you know, you can't deny the fact that at 13 by 19, 3 megapixels and 4 megapixels on the iPhone looks great. So,
yes, absolutely.
So yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you can get a decent size print from those things. And if you are working with the limitations and not allowing them to hold you back, it's a perfectly acceptable device.
Well, and let's remember too that, you know, creativity happens within constraints better than it does without constraints.
Yes.
So
yes.
People that are saying, oh, you know, I really can't do this until I have this kind of camera or this kind of lens. And I think, oh, just save your money. Just take what you have and go out and photograph. Now, yes, if you're a sports photographer, if you have a special niche in, or as you pointed out, photographing red crowned cranes or whatever, you will have challenges if you don't have particular. I mean, I do safaris once a year, and I can't imagine photographing a safari without a 300-28 with a doubler on it. But
yeah.
You know, because those lions, you don't just go up to a lion with a wide angle lens, you know. I mean, God help you if you try. So having said that, I did a safari with a woman who accompanied her husband, who had all the gear, and this woman shot the entire safari on her iPhone, and every night she showed us photographs, and she had a blast. She had so much fun. Now, admittedly, she was shooting different stuff, very different stuff, with very small animals in the distance, you know. But she was really having a great time, and she didn't allow her lack of technology or gear to get in the way. And I think that's really important. I think understanding as creative people that there will always be constraints. And if your constraints is you can't print bigger than A3, then that's what you do. Not every artist in the world needs a canvas the size of a room.
Right, right. I just got back from an expedition in Antarctica with a photographer out of Australia named David Burren. While we were there, I was amazed. I wasn't particularly amazed, but I was quite happy to find that there were a couple of the older ladies that were with us on the expedition. They'd turned up on their own. They weren't with their husbands or anything. They were on their own. And one of them had, I forget the exact serial number, the model, but there was this one old girl who had a Canon, I forget what it was. It was a relatively small camera anyway. Actually, you know what? This probably, again, I'm stumbling on these segues here. What I was going to say was, you know, she was gutted because she had two of these small, like compact, what I call compact digital cameras. And she was coming out with some amazing shots. You know, she was even managing to, she'd got so used to working with the limitations of the shutter lag that she even got a few shots of the wildlife in really, really critical moments. That people with less experience and less skill, I guess, could get with a digital SLR with virtually no shutter lag. She was really rocking those cameras.
Good for her.
Yeah. But yeah, that it reminds me of the we have a mutual friend, Nancy Lehrer, who pointed me to. I mean, I go and read your blog relatively regularly and always catch up when I do, but Nancy pointed me to a post a couple of weeks ago where you talked about the term point and shoot for compact, what I call compact digital cameras. I forget the term that you were using instead, but you know, you've raised a great point that pointing and shooting is really that's a way of shooting, not a type of camera. It's a well yeah what are you What do you think about that?
The whole argument came up when I bought recently Fuji's new camera, the X100.
Oh, and I'm lusting after that camera.
and rightly you should. It is a beautiful, beautiful camera. I'm in awe of this camera. It's gorgeous. Mm. And I'd read a number of, you know, reviews and that sort of thing. And there were people saying, oh, it's just a $1,200 iPhone. And, you know, it's just this, it's just that. It's just a expensive point and shoot. Mm. And I get agitated because I think, you know, the same thing could be said about the Leicas that Henri Cartier-Bresson used. I mean, ultimately, it's just a box with a hole in it. And to dismiss someone's camera and say, oh, it's just a point and shoot, it's just so irrelevant. Right. The fact is, if you choose to, quote, point and shoot, if that's the best you can say about your photography, then that's truly, it has more to do with the fact that you're not mindful, you're not receptive, you're just going out and, you know, point and shoot.
Right.
But use whatever camera you need to. And if it's a small compact, if it's a Leica, if it's a Hasselblad, whatever, go out with your box with a hole in it and make the best photographs you can. But whatever your camera is, do it mindfully, do it with the understanding. I mean, most of us, we photograph for one of two reasons. We want to express ourselves, whether anyone ever hears us or not, or we want to communicate. And the communication occurs always in, you know, context of eventually some kind of audience. Mm. If you want to express yourself, do it in whatever way makes you happy. The brand on your camera isn't going to matter to you, or maybe it does, but it doesn't matter to anyone else. Mm. And if you're going to communicate, then no one's going to look at your photograph and say, oh, what, did he shoot it with a Leica? Did he shoot it with a Hasselblad? They're going to look at the photograph, and photographs should be judged on their own merits, not on the merits of what camera created it. And so this whole idea that we've kind of relegated a whole segment of frankly, beautiful little cameras to being, quote, not serious cameras or point-and-shoot cameras, when they're just small cameras and they do everything. Maybe they're shutter lag, maybe they don't have the greatest optics, but whatever, those things, perfection with, you know, perfect gigantic files, a D3X with a gorgeous 300-28 with optical stabilized, all of this stuff. Nobody's ever moved by perfection. Mm. You know, we're moved by, there's some reason people like Robert Capa, you go to an exhibit and you look at his work and think, oh my gosh, look at that stuff. And you're looking at these grainy, movement-filled, barely focused photographs, but they're moving because there's something more than just technical perfection. And I think we, as a community, we get so caught up in, you know, the big photo sellers, whether they're in the Americas or Europe, they're all on the same thing. You know, you need digital video, you need this, you need to shoot like a pro. Mm. And they're just trying to clean our wallets out. And there's some amazing people running some amazing camera stores, and they do a lot of good, but there are these moments when I just want to strangle them because there are these, you know, I'm passionate about amateur photographers going out and learning what they can learn with the cameras they have, and they feel like they can't because I only have a, you know, oh, are you a photographer? Well, not really. I only have this camera. And I wish I could say to them all, you are a photographer. You may not be Henri Cartier-Bresson, you may not be insert favorite name of iconic photographer here, but you're you, and you're creating work. Do it with the camera you've got. If all you have is an old Pentax Spotmatic, create some beautiful work with it. If you've got a Hasselblad, then, you know, create beautiful work with that. But nobody cares what camera it is, except us. And we're morons. Every time the new camera companies comes out and goes, oh, but you really need this one. You go, yes, yes, I do. I do. Everything else I've created up until now is rubbish. I really, really do. How much can I pay you for that? And you buy it, and you've had it for a week, and you start realizing my photographs aren't getting any better. They're bigger. They're like really big now. Like, do we need really big photographs that still aren't moving anyone? It might just be better to have smaller photographs if they're rubbish. Yeah. And I find the whole thing, it's very amusing, but at times it all builds up and I have to have a rant about it. And that was, that blog post is called Point and Shoot My Ass. And I truly just, I think, you know, honestly, some of this nonsense needs to be addressed. And I get it. You know, someone's going to write into your email and say, you know, well, you can't you need the biggest shutter speed, fastest thing. I get it. For some photography, there is a need. And some of this technology has taken us really far. But let's not forget that 5 years ago, we were creating images with these cameras that were the latest and greatest, going, oh my gosh, look at this. Look at this photograph. Well, these so-called point-and-shoot cameras now have technology that is better than that. And there's no reason why we should be dismissive of it. And you go to a camera club meeting or you see someone that's shooting and you think, oh, he's only shooting with this. Oh, he's got one of those crappy Canon Rebels. And I would really like to sort of say to everyone, you know what? Look at their photographs before you dismiss them, because there's people out there shooting with some like hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of gear, and they've got podcasts, and they're just, and you look at the photographs and go, really? Because my 7-year-old with a point and shoot could have done better than that. I don't have a 7-year-old, I have a cat, but I'm pretty sure my cats with point and shoots, so-called, could do better than that. So let's not forget that the technology only takes us so far. It's the heart of an artist, it's their eye, it's their skill, it's their practice. Those things matter. And you can't buy those, you know. So spend your energy on that and just use whatever box or the hole in it you've got. You know, if it's got a red dot on it, great. If it's got Nikon on it, fine. But whatever, go make some beautiful photographs. Because when you're long, if when you're dead, no one's going to care what camera you had. The only thing that's going to move them in terms of your legacy as a photographer is your
It's the
photography.
photographer. I mean, I'd be a hypocrite if I didn't say what I'm about to say. But I mean, I am a gearhead. I love my gear and all of that. But at the end of the day, you know, I agree wholeheartedly, 100% with what you're saying, in that it is all about the photograph. And although I've got two Canon 1-series bodies, I've got 10 plus L lenses. Canon love me, but I have them all in my I'm gonna say arsenal, because there's a place for them. And I shoot a type of photography that requires a 600 millimeter lens at $10,000, and that sort of thing. But what's in my bag all the time? It's either in my pocket, my iPhone, or in my bag at the moment is a Canon PowerShot S95. Great little camera.
Beautiful little camera.
It is, and that gives me enough control to be, you know, to be able to, I can shoot in manual with that. I can control the exposure. It's great. I'm getting some relatively nice work out of that camera because it's with me all the time.
Sure. And let's not forget, I mean, you know, I mean, my tagline for years has been gear is good, vision is better. And once in a while, someone comes up and they're like, oh, you're in your vision stuff. And blah, blah, blah. Gear is still important. I'm like, I said gear is good. I geek out with the best of them. Honest, I can geek out. But it's a question of what you like more and what's more important to you. And so I kind of like to try to, you know, in most things, kind of take the middle path and say, well, you know, is it really, does it have to be gear or vision? I mean, you know, one without the other stalls at some point. And so you need your 600 millimeter lens and you've invested a lot of money in it. But let's be honest, you put the 600 millimeter lens in your 1DS Mark III in the hands of someone who hasn't spent the years perfecting your craft. And you will still get very close pictures of monkeys in Japan, but there will not be tension. There will not be balance. The composition will suffer. They won't have a sense of moment, and they won't understand the light. All of these things that make our craft what it is, the gear will only take you so far. And so, I will geek out with the best of them, but ultimately, it's the photographer. And yes, you may have all of that gear and still create total crap. And frankly, there are people out there that have one camera with one lens that are creating beautiful work. They're not photographing monkeys or red-crowned cranes or whatever. They're probably not doing, you know, humanitarian work in Africa. They have their own thing that they do and love, and their tools are adequate for the job. But it's the photographer. And if photographers could spend more time actually talking about photographs, they would be better photographers, because we talk and talk and talk about gear, and once you've got it in your hand and you're looking through it, then it's a question of what are you going to do with that? How do you get tension in your photograph? How do you build a sense of depth in your photograph? I've just started well, just finished actually a new ebook that I'll be launching at the end of the month. And it's about building depth into a photograph. And I don't think I've ever been sat in a conversation with a photographer saying, you know, how do we talk about photographs? How do we talk about depth? How do we talk about the things that actually move people? We're talking, if, you know, compare this to writers. Writers don't sit and just talk about words. They don't talk about sentences. They don't talk about, they sure don't talk about their laptops and how they wrote their, you know, they talk about devices. They talk about story. They talk about things that move people. And I really think that it's time for, and there are photographers out there that talk about this stuff. We just don't hear from them because they're out actually making photographs instead of posting on blogs like you and I, right? But, you know, the popular photography world, it's time that we, there were some voices that said, I think it's enough. I think we've got enough gear. Yeah. The gear will get replaced as it does. But let's talk about things that actually make good photographs. Let's talk about things that actually move people.
Yeah. So you touched on something there about, you know, the, if you know, the camera being adequate for the or meeting the requirements of the person that only wants to shoot this or just wants to shoot that or what. I mean, I don't like to use only just there, but you know, one other thing that I touched on earlier when I was quoting, well, not directly quoting, but you know, talking about within the frame, is that you talked about taking the right amount of gear. And you know, for years I used to carry everything that I owned. My camera bag got bigger each year, and I would take everything that I owned for fear of wanting it in the field. But then, you know, I mean, I probably got into my 40s and my body wasn't quite as nimble and strong as it used to be, although I try. And I started to regulate what I shoot, and the more I shot as well, you know, there's a certain amount of gear that you have to have with you to keep your creative options open. But it's not necessarily everything, and it's not necessarily the latest and greatest camera body or whatever. But I mean, there are focal lengths that you'll need for certain jobs. And you touched on this in Within the Frame. And I'd like to just sort of, you know, touch on this again here as well, in that, you know, there is a fine balance between trying to take everything that you think you might need. And then, you know, I mean, in Antarctica this last couple of months ago, I had a really, really good balance. But the only thing that I found that I took that I could have not done was my macro. I took my 100mm macro, and I ended up leaving that on one of my bunks for most of the landings. So it didn't slow me down. Only in the fact that I had to carry it all the way over to Buenos Aires and then out down to Antarctica. But once I was there, it didn't slow me down so much. But I did get a really good balance. But it's difficult. I mean, finding that balance, knowing what you expect to shoot, and preparing and taking just the gear to shoot that, it's hard. So you know, maybe we could talk about that for a while as well. I mean, what sort of things do you keep in mind now, David?
Well, I think, I mean, the primary consideration, of course, is there a client back home that's expecting you to deliver the shot? Because people, I've shown up at airports with so much stuff, and my traveling companions laugh at me because I don't travel light. You know, I think traveling light is a great idea, but if there's a client back home that wants me to get a certain shot list accomplished, they're not paying me to travel light.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, they're paying me to get the shot, so it's whatever it takes. Having said that, you know, sometimes taking too much stuff gets in the way. And over the years, I mean, I used to bring 3 Canon 580EXs and pocket wizards and soft boxes. And after a few assignments where you don't use any of it, you start going, I don't think I'm going to bring this. And if I need it, I'll work around it. And so in the end, you end up with a couple of collapsible light discs that work for you. You begin to understand that your focal lengths, you know, you want to double up on some things. If a lens goes south or you drop it or someone steals it, you want to have a second, but you want to be intelligent about it. Having said that, if it's a personal trip, then you just go, you know, what are my goals for this trip? What do I really want to accomplish? Bearing in mind, I can't do it all. Do I need that 24mm tilt shift? Maybe it's all I need. Maybe I go with a 24 tilt shift and just get really good at that and focus in on something. Because ultimately, you know, when you go to these places, you can't shoot with every lens at once. You're going to miss things. You're going to miss opportunities. And as I said earlier, you got to trust the fact that creativity happens within constraints. So if you show up with three lenses and that's all you have, you will, if you're not, all other things being equal, you will create beautiful photographs. The difference is, the client sending you there to take, you know, really close-up pictures of penguins, or are they wanting sweeping landscapes? Because if you get to decide that, well, you bring whatever lenses you want and play. If the client says, I really need that, you know, that close-up picture of an emperor penguin, well, then, you know, now, having said that, I have a feeling those penguins don't really care too much how close you get to them, but you might just use that 100 millimeter macro. But you do your research, and then you ask yourself, you know, what is the best tool for the job? What do I really need? And then, yeah, leave the rest at home or bring it all, you know, but ultimately, you got to remember, you can't use every lens on your camera at once. And you will miss more opportunities if you're thinking, okay, what lens do I use? Oh, maybe I should switch to this, or maybe, and you're looking down in your bag, you're switching lenses. You know, are you there to play with your gear, or are you there to make photographs? Some of us are there to play with our gear. I acknowledge that. I've seen them. There are photographers out there who got into this to play with gear. And if that's what you want to do, then bless you. Just remember, the two activities are not synonymous. Talking about photography is not making photographs. Talking about gear, playing with gear, is not making photographs. The only thing, it turns out, the only thing that is making photographs is actually making photographs.
So
the balance of gear is really subjective, and it's, I think it's a question of, you know, listen to your gut, make sure you've got the gear that you need for the you know, the bulk of the photographs that you need, and then be willing to play, be willing to trust that idea that creativity happens within constraints. And if all you've got is a 24, come back with some incredible photographs with a 24 millimeter, because there will always be a piece of gear you don't have.
I didn't
have the 1DS Mark III this time. Oh, if I'd had a crop sensor. Oh, if I'd had. Well, you didn't. So stop whining. Pick what you have and go make something beautiful. Whining isn't photography either.
Right.
it's a heavy part of my photography, but as it turns out, it is not actually photography.
I think it's important. It's an important part of the motivation of a photographer to have a few ghosts back there where you missed something because you didn't have a lens with you, or because you just didn't have the experience at the time to really capitalize on a moment. But yeah, I mean, in Antarctica, it was very tempting for me to pack my 600 millimeter as well, because there was going to be wildlife and I liked to get in close. But, you know, I knew that it would slow me down too much, so it stayed at home. The longest lens I took was my 300 millimeter 2.8, but I did have the extenders and they worked well with it. So I knew that I could get out to 600 if I needed to. But I generally was happy with the decisions that I, you know, with the gear that I took, and it worked out well. The only thing that I could have gotten away with not taking was the macro, but you know, I think you also point out in one of your books that, you know, extension tubes are a good way of working around that as well. They're small, they're light. And if you think you might need to get in close, an extension tube's often a good, I mean, I had my extension tubes with me as well, because I knew that I wouldn't be taking everything out with me on each landing, but I always had the extension tubes in my pocket in case I did need to get a bit closer. But, you know, these are all considerations, and you learn more, the more you do it, you learn more, and, you sort of, you know, you start to strike a balance. And you don't get it right every time, and then you get your little ghosts that haunt you when you miss something, but they drive you to be better next time, or to put up with the extra weight when you do take the extra lens or something. But it's all experience. It's all about learning from what you did right and what you did wrong.
I think the reality, Martin, is even if you go and you bring all the right gear, here's one more ghost to haunt you, you're going to create a beautiful, incredible images that 3, 4, or 5 years from now, you're not going to like. So ultimately, we are all creating work that we will one day replace with something that better expresses what we have to say.
Yeah.
So to freak out about this stuff, especially for new photographers, to freak out about it when really by the end of the year, you're going to look back on that work that once you loved, you just couldn't believe you'd made that photograph. And, you know, you should be proud of it at this point in your progress. But later on, you're going to look back and go, you know, I could have done better. Well, good news is you will do better.
Yeah.
So freaking out about all of the gear, because, I mean, let's face it, Martin, had you gone without your 300 2.8, there are images that you would have come back from Antarctica that were, you wouldn't have come back with some of those photographs, but you would have come back with other ones.
Oh,
you
sure.
would have
yeah.
come back with something different. And so again, unless you're shooting for a client or you have a very specific need, then you shoot with what you have and you make use of it. And that's what photography is about.
Yeah.
Not everyone can afford that 300 2.8. I mean, I'm going to Antarctica at the end of this year and I'm planning that's will probably be the longest lens. It will be the longest lens to bring. It's longest lens I own, but you know, it's, I'll bring it, but I do wonder, I mean, maybe I should just go with, you know, this 24 millimeter tilt shift and, you know, and a couple smaller lenses and just see what happens. You know, it would be an interesting experiment because, again, I know there will be photographs I miss, but
David,
there will also be photographs you take.
If you're going to put your body through the Drake Passage for 3 days to get down there, take at least your 70 to 200 as well.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
But you really, know, you could get away down there with a 70 to 200 and a 1.4 extender. And if it's the new, you know, I don't want to get too much into the gear here, but if it's the new 70 to 200 and the new Mark III extender, then the 2x1 works well with that as well. So I, you know, just in case anyone's thinking about this stuff, but yeah, it's, I know exactly what you mean. One of the things, I mean, I often, you've mentioned a few times, you know, that if it's a commercial job, some of the work that I do is commercial and I need to be carrying certain gear because I've got a shot list. But I also, you know, because I push a lot of work out there as prints, and that's one of my revenue streams, you know, the prints that I make from my images. And so in some ways, when I'm in places like that, especially if I've laid out good money to get to a location, I kind of make myself my own client. You know, I want to come back with a certain number of images because I want to, you know, generate some revenue from those images.
Sure.
And so, you know, I kind of make myself my own client in some respects. But yeah, I mean, I totally agree with what you're saying.
I think that making your, I just wrote an article about this. Because everyone wants to have these great high profile clients on their resume. But for the last couple of years, I've been working to a point where I am my only client. And because there is much greater freedom there, and it's a tough place to get to. It's a long game. You've really got to, you know, do it right. But you're right. When you are your own client, you still have a client.
Yeah.
You know, and I still, if I'm going out on a project where I'm doing my own thing, I will still give myself a shot list and I will still bring a certain amount of gear. Now, I'm a little more forgiving at times because while I'm there, I can start making excuses, and being my own client, I will actually listen to those excuses and get swayed by them.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Maybe we shouldn't go out shooting today. Maybe we should just sit in and have noodle soup and tea. And, but you do, as your own client, you frankly, you probably have higher expectations and you bring the right gear. But again, it always comes down to take the right gear for the job.
Yeah.
Don't take more than you need, but certainly take enough that if everything goes south, you've got what you need to work it through.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then be the best photographer that you can be, knowing that your gear will only take you so far.
Right. Right. So, you know, I know for the guy that that coined the phrase "gear is good, vision is better," we've spoke quite a lot about the gear, but in a way that I like. But I want to just sort of start to talk. I want to talk a little bit about the fact. You know, I noticed that you have made a transition to Nikon bodies or Nikon bodies, however you say that. But you know, you made a transition to Nikon bodies and Sigma lenses in 2011. How's that been?
It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's been really great. And I made the transition in part because I just couldn't wait to see what, you know, the rabble rousers were going to say about it. And because I just had this unique opportunity where Sigma approached me and said, you know, we're doing a program with some photographers in Canada, and, you know, would you be willing to use our lenses? And I said, absolutely. Just make a Nikon mount and you got a deal. And it's been really fun, in part because so much of what I do is in education. And so for me to be able to say to students, look, you can get a good lens for less than $1,800. Look at the Sigma equivalent. And is it as good? No, I mean, my Sigma lenses, for one, for me, they're not sealed, and so that's a detriment. Do they focus as well? In some cases, absolutely, they do. They have different properties. But it's been really fun to create some photographs that I'm really proud of, and I could stack them up against any Nikon lens. In terms of the actual photograph, you wouldn't. No one's going to look at my work and go, "Well, this is clearly his, his off-brand series. These aren't shot with the Nikon. They were shot with something else." So for me to be able to say to my students, "Look, you don't need a 1DS Mark III and the Canon L lens. You don't need a D3X and Nikon's 300-28 or whatever. Maybe you do. Some do. If you're shooting in places like Africa where you need a sealed, I would love to have sealed lenses. And eventually, there are some lenses in my what I currently shoot with the Sigma EX series, I will eventually replace with some of the Nikon lenses because they are sealed and they are built for some of the really harsh circumstances that I photograph in. But in terms of, I'm not a pixel peeper. I don't look at my stuff at 300%, and I barely notice chromatic aberration. Someone's got to point it out to me. I'm just not that kind of photographer. And so for me and for a lot of my students, something like a Sigma EX lens, which is generally well built, has got good optics. I mean, their 85 1.4 is it focuses a little slower, but it's sharp and it's a beautiful lens. It's not the same. Just as if you took a Nikon 50 1.4 and stacked it up against a Canon 1.4, you'd find differences in the bokeh, you'd find differences in the build. But again, in terms of the end result, it's been really fun. And switching from Canon to Nikon has forced me to develop a new way of photographing, including having photographs that are in focus more often than not. But I just read a review of a guy that did a similar thing, and he said, "Look, it's sort of a six of one, half dozen of the other. The Nikon lenses sometimes hunt a little more to get that focus. When they get it, it's perfect. The Canon doesn't hunt as much, but when they get it, it's sometimes imperfect. So the question is, you take three frames with either one. Which ones do you want to? I mean, what are you more comfortable with? Hunting and missing the shot, or getting the shot and having it be blurry?" I mean, it's pick your poison. But I have loved transferring to Nikon because I used to photograph with Nikon when I was in film, and through a number of a series of events, I just ended up digitally with Canon. So being back with Nikon, the ergonomics fit me nicely, and it's been really fun just to switch my creative process because suddenly you don't know where all the buttons are, and you have to be really, again, going back to this idea of being mindful and intentional and receptive, you have to pay a little more attention to what you're doing. And that's been a gift for me. I'll get comfortable with these bodies again and shoot a little more intuitively. But for me, it was not everyone's in a position where they can do it, but I was looking to change and it came at the right time. And I quite like it. My D3S bodies, I absolutely adore them. Would I shoot with Canon again? Like, had this not happened, I'd still be shooting with Canon. I'd still be creating beautiful photographs and a lot of junk, that nobody ever sees. It has not changed my creative life so much because gear really, ultimately, again, barring some of these very specific, someone's going to write and go, "I'm an astrophotographer and I shoot in space shuttles." And well, okay, well, whatever. For the rest of us, the gear is really quite secondary. It does matter, and obviously, as there are advances, and great. But it is always secondary to your vision because, as Ansel Adams says, there's nothing worse than, a fuzzy photograph of a sharp concept. I think is how he said it. And I disagree with him in the sense that I think there is. I think a fuzzy photograph of a fuzzy concept is also really bad too. But, having said that, I just think if we can collectively maybe pour our hearts more into the photographs than into our gear, we'll be taking a step in the right direction.
So I think we're coming up on an hour here, David. So I don't want to keep you much longer. But before we finish, do you have any exciting projects coming up or anything that you can talk about that that you want to share with the audience?
Well, I think I mean, my big exciting project right now is walking again.
Well,
I'm really,
good luck
really
on that
excited.
one.
Yeah,
Stick
I
with
know.
it.
It should be a lot of fun. I have a book that actually was announced a while back called Photographically Speaking that we're now kind of we're coming close to the deadlines and missing them by a long shot. This last couple of months when I've been lying in hospital beds, etc., I was meant to be creating photographs for the book. So my deadline's getting pushed back a little bit, but that's still coming. It should be released at the end of the year sometime. Amazon has it on right now, I think, as a release date of end of October. But photographically speaking, I'm really excited because I've been talking about vision for so long, and at a certain point I said to my audience, you know, I think we've talked about vision enough in terms of the very specific discussion. I think it's now it's time to talk about expression. How do we express that vision? And so this is sort of the first book in that, taking the discussion of vision and saying, okay, now that we've talked about all this, how do we express? What do photographs say? And so that's what photographically speaking is about. And then more kind of currently, I've got my new ebook coming out, and these are fun for me because they're little, you know, they're not that big. I mean, ultimately, they sort of equivalent to about a 30-page article, but they're an opportunity for me to tackle one subject and for $5 get people really excited about, you know, something that I think really changes our photography. In this case, it's about depth and how we add a sense or a feeling of depth, because the camera flattens. When you make that two-dimensional photograph, you flatten a three-dimensional world, and we live and breathe in the three-dimensional world. And so when you flatten it, you take away that experience of a three-dimensional world. And that's why you get, you know, telephone poles coming out of heads and that kind of thing. But more than that, how do we reintroduce this feeling of depth so that we have photographs that pull us in and that make us visually not just look at a photograph, but look through and into a photograph? And so this book is called A Deeper Frame, and I'll be releasing that at the end of the month. And I'm pretty excited about it because, again, it's my first in like 6 months. I've been so busy with other things that to finally kind of come back around and put an ebook out there it's fun for me. I really enjoy it. So I'm kind of excited about it. There's always kind of around the time we launch an ebook, there's some excitement, and it's always nice to see some receptivity and people saying, you know, this has changed the way I create photographs. It's always nice to see that.
Great. And that'll be available along with the rest of your books on craftandvision.com, right?
Yeah, I will. Yeah, and
Yeah.
it'll be announced on my blog. I think on the 28th, we're doing the big
Okay.
announcement and that sort of thing. So.
I look forward to that. I look forward to photographically speaking as well. Amazon do have it already listed, like you say. I've already created a link to that for the blog post. So if someone wants to pre-order, then you can do that as well. No need to be, you know, if you're driving at the moment, don't be there making notes as you go along. It's dangerous. We don't want you in the Poorly Photographers Society.
True.
But yeah, all of these things will be on there. I'll also include David's website and David's blog, and David on Twitter, Pixelated Image on Twitter. I'll put all of these links into the show notes as well, so you won't need to be making any notes as you listen to this. But David, it's been absolutely amazing having you on the podcast, and I've been a fan for a long time. It's a little bit of a dream come true for me to sit here and talk with you this morning. So I wish it had been under better circumstances, whereas, you know, you've just fallen off a wall and I've just found out I've got a brain tumor. But these things will make, you know, we'll both be stronger for this, and we both have a better appreciation for life and for the amazing community that we're part of.
You're
So.
absolutely right, and you know, I know that my blog community, you know, wishes you all the best as you recover. And maybe once we're through this, we'll make a plan to go shooting in Japan together or something, and take our minds off it.
I can't wait.
It'll be fun.
But yeah, it will be very, very cool if we could do something together. I'm going to be in the States at some point as well, and Canada. And so, you know, even if it's just to blow the froth off a few, I'll definitely stop by and we can say hello.
Absolutely.
But
I love it. First pint's on me.
So yeah, the second will be on me, and hopefully the 10th as well.
All right. Well, we'll work out the math later.
Yeah. No, seriously. I mean, it'd be great to meet you at some point, David. You know, I've got so much respect for you and your work and what you do. Thanks on behalf of the whole photography community for the stuff that you create and put out there. You're making a difference. You're doing such great things, and you know, partly because of that, and partly because you're just a really, really, really nice guy. I thank you even more for your time today and for talking with us on the podcast.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thanks, Martin.
Thank you.
This is Dave Warner, and I'm the host of the LensFlare35.com podcast. Each week I bring you interviews with some of the top photographers using digital SLR cameras. They share some of their coolest tips and tricks, techniques, and news about what they're up to. So please take a moment to visit the website or subscribe to LensFlare 35 on iTunes.
The Martin Bailey Photography Podcast is a proud member of the Photocast Network. Find this and other great photography podcasts at photocastnetwork.com.